The music and the words are familiar. Of course, the Hatikva, the hope. The anthem of the Zionist movement for many decades. An anthem with whose slightly changed verse has become the national anthem of the State of Israel. I want to use the words of Hatikva and this discussion of what Zionism is. But I'd like first for you to allow me a digression. Sometimes it's simply interesting to know something of those behind a great melody, a great song, meaning. Hatikva, the words are written by a poet by the name of Naftali Herz Imber. They're written some 90 years ago. Imber remains one of the most interesting, difficult, pugnacious, Bacchanalian, bohemian, patriotic Jews than we've had in recent times. He deserves to be known. He's something of an Eastern European Heinrich Heine or a Jewish François Villon. And I think that if you know something about him, you may appreciate the Hatikva even a little bit more. In Galicia, a little all-Jewish town in the very heart of the all-Jewish Pale of the Settlement, in a very traditional place among a very Orthodox people, Imber was born in the year 1856. And he possessed that one talent which was most prized of all among these Eastern European Jews, a photographic mind, agility, intellectual agility. He was what was called an Ilui, a boy genius. By the time he was 10, he had memorized the Bible and much of the great ocean that is Talmudic literature. A boy possessed of this kind of mind was more often than not in this world destined for the rabbinate. He had the rabbinic mind. But what he lacked was the rabbinic soul. For there was nothing pious, there was nothing honest, there was nothing very straight about Imber. He loved to manipulate people. He was a rather weak, self-indulgent person. He was that kind of person whose mind was far more capable than the rest of him. And worst of all, he was footloose and fancy-free. And how did a Jew boy in Galicia, poor, possessed of no language but Yiddish, how did he break out into the larger world? Well, blessed with a facile pen, Imber discovered when he was still a very young teenager that the way to break out into the larger world was to flatter that world. And so he wrote fulsome praise, panegyrics, to all the local wealthy non-Jews, to the local duke and lord, and even to the emperor Franz Joseph. And in time, these worthies wanted to know who was this very loyal young subject of theirs. They wanted to reward this young high school student. So they invited him to the palace, and he was presented with a purse and a passport. And he learned his first and basic lesson about life, that flattery does get you a long way. In this case, flattery took him to Vienna, and then to Budapest, and then to Constantinople. And in Constantinople, Imber discovered a fellow Bohemian, a titled British nobleman, many years his senior, Sir Lawrence Oliphant, a mystic, poet, also a man who loved the grape a little bit too much, and women a little bit too much. And Oliphant was on his way to the Holy Land for many reasons. The first was that he was a fundamentalist Christian, and he believed implicitly in the doctrine that the return of the Jews to the Holy Land was a prerequisite for the second coming of the Christ. And in part because he was a mystic who believed that the air of the Holy Land was somehow purer, more divine, better able to give a man the powers of prophecy. And thirdly, because he was a promoter, a land speculator. He had decided that there were enough Mishugaim, enough foolish, wealthy English people who were mystics, who would love to go to the Holy Land if things could be made rather comfortable for them there, to engage in spiritual enterprises, mysticism, love, contemplation. He was on his way to a place near Haifa, which he'd bought for a song, where he was going to build a great sensitivity center for English mystics and make a little money out of it. And Oliphant discovered Imber, or Imber discovered Oliphant, and somehow out of this wedding, the two of them went to the Holy Land, the Yiddish-speaking poet and the English mystical rake, and they lived there together for 6 years, and they built this great spiritual center. It sounds very modern, doesn't it? And finally, Oliphant turned it into a good thing, and there was some argument about how much of the good thing Mr. Imber should get. Imber went back to London in this case. But while he was in the Holy Land, something of the mystery, the mystique, the spiritual force of its history communicated itself to Imber. He was still a Jew, and this was still Zion. And at the time of the dedication of the colony of Petach Tikva, the gates of hope, he set down HaTikva, the hope. The great poem. It's one of the very few, very straight, open, easy poems that he has. Most of his poetry is sarcastic, sardonic, bitter. But this is open and lyrical and full of a simple love of the land. I'll come back, of course, to HaTikva. But let me tell you a little more about our Rolling Stone. From London to Paris, from Paris to Berlin, from Berlin to Bombay, India was still the mecca of that world as it is of ours. But in Bombay, his prophecy got a little better of him. The Indians were not as susceptible to praise as we Westerners are. And he found himself destitute in the port city of Bombay. And the only way he could get back to England was to feign a conversion to Christianity and to appeal to a mission in the area for food and lodging and for a first-class ticket back on the local steamer. And so he got. Then he came from London to New York. This was the Golden Medina. Here he'd find great patrons. But New York was too crowded for him, and off he went to the west, to Denver, to Phoenix, to Leadsville, to the silver mining towns, his rolling adventure of ours. In America, he met and he married one of the first liberated women, a Protestant, an MD, one of the first women to receive her medical degree in the United States. She converted to Judaism in order to marry Imber, and apparently they were very happy together for 2 or 3 years until he simply walked out of the house. He was as liberated as she was, which incidentally is a danger of liberation. And then his powers began to run out, and Americans were busy with a lot of other things besides paying off a panegyrist. He ended up in the east side of New York, a drunk, destitute. And he died in 1906, impoverished. But 10,000 Jews in New York, east side Jews, poor Jews, followed his coffin to its simple grave. And behind the coffin, they carried high a placard on which they had written the beautiful Hebrew verse of HaTikva. The one great song of his which is still sung and remembered. When he had been in Israel way back in the 1880s, Imber had read HaTikva to some of the settlers in Rishon LeZion, in the colony that Lord Rothschild sponsored for his wine-making processes, first in Zion. And a member of that colony by the name of Samuel Cohn had felt that the verse which Imber had written would fit well into the melody of a familiar Bessarabian, Romanian folk song. And he picked up his guitar and they began to sing HaTikva to that song. And it became familiar throughout the early Yishuv. And the settlers brought it to World Zionist Congresses in this form, and it began to be sung by delegates to these congresses from the world over. And so it passed into the hearts and into the spirits of world Jewry. Well, that's the background of HaTikvah. And obviously a song which becomes the anthem is more than a song. When the pioneers came to the Holy Land in the 1870s and 80s, they were young. They were a band of pioneers, chalutzim. They faced insuperable odds. They needed song to carry them along through their work and through the dangerous days and the more dangerous nights. But there were no Zionist songs in those days. There was no Israeli music. The music of the Jew was the music of the synagogue. And it was precisely this music which these young pioneers were rebelling against. For the people came to the synagogue and sang of the coming of the Messiah. And they stayed in their synagogues. And that's what Zionism in one way was all about. Get out of the synagogues and go and build the land yourself. Don't wait for the miracle. Somehow the words of hope, of return to the land, combined with a bit of music which was familiar to many from their Eastern European backgrounds, because almost all of the early settlers of Israel were from Eastern Europe, this kind of mixture of wedding, of music and of meaning, went directly to the hearts of these early Zionist pioneers, spoke to them of the movement, and perhaps offers us the best key to understand what they were all about. So long as the heart of the Jew and his eye is turned to the east, so long does our ancient hope of returning to Zion still live. Odlo avda tikvatenu, our hope is not yet lost. Hatikva hanoshana, the ancient hope. Lashuv le'eretz avotenu, to return to the land of our fathers, Eretz Tzion, Yerushalayim, the land of Zion and Jerusalem. Zionism was, from the very beginning, a desperate movement of nation building. HaTikvah begins in a sense of incompletion. Life is somehow inadequate for the Jew. The Jew, wherever he is in Europe, finds himself an outcast, an alien, a pariah, beyond the pale. Somehow he does not feel that he has a future on that continent. But there is the ancient hope, the hope of song, of liturgy, of God's promise in the covenant, Lashuv le'eretz avotenu, to return to the land of our fathers, the land promised in the covenant with Abraham, to the land, to Zion, to the city of Jerusalem, to the temple, to the spiritual heart, the spiritual roots of our people. Zionism was a movement of national self-determination. I use those words deliberately because they were words which were familiar to many other nationalist movements in Europe in the 19th century. We tend to take the existence of nation states for granted. We forget that it's hardly 100 years since Germany and Italy emerged from the feudal hodgepodge of authorities into a nation state. The 19th century was the time in which the feudal world finally broke down with all the very complicated series of relationships between classes of men, between lords and their vassals, between corporations in the society. The feudal world did not know the nation state. But in the 19th century, the nation state began to emerge as a geographic area in which people of a certain inheritance or a certain language of familiarity shared a common citizenship. Nationalism emerged as a movement of liberalization. The feudal world was a hierarchical world. In the world of nation states, within the borders of the state, all would be equal. Locke's social compact, social contract. In the state, all would be equal, equal members of that state. And so wherever there were large groups of people who shared a language and shared common traditions, and where the borders seemed proper and appropriate and defensible, The mergers began to take place. Bavaria and Prussia and Schleswig-Holstein and all the communities of Germany coalesced into Germany. Parma, Turin, Naples, Venice coalesced through the Risorgimento, the nation, the movement of national self-determination in Italy, into the state of Italy. And these movements went underground in the great Austro-Hungarian Empire and in Eastern Europe until the end of the First World War, when finally Romania and Bulgaria and Yugoslavia and Hungary emerge as nation states. Jewish nationalism emerged in an era of European nationalism and borrowed many of the same ideas, the same idealism, and the same hope. But at the same time, Jewish nationalism is a response to some of the failures of European nationalism. The ideal of nationalism as it developed during the Enlightenment, during the 18th century, was simple enough. There would be a community of men within a certain geographical area. And all of these people, regardless of their religion or their background, would be equal citizens of a republic or of their state. But as nationalism emerged in the 19th century, it became wedded with a kind of romanticism. It became chauvinism. Germany, instead of simply being the development of a nation called Germany within certain borders, became the land of Siegfried, of Teutomania, of Wagner. Germany looked for the blood, the myth, the ethnic roots which were truly German. And it denied full citizenship, at least on an emotional level, and then quickly on an economic level, and to a certain degree on a legal level, to those who did not share the blood, who did not share the full ancestry of the German-speaking peoples, who were not Teutons and Aryans. Whether it was religion, or blood, or ancestry, the nation-state tried inevitably to develop a myth that there were some who were true Germans, Italians, Bulgarians, Romanians, and then there were the outsiders. And the Jew obviously was always among the outsiders. He did not share the blood. He had come from a different place. And he did not share the old faith, whatever it was, Greek Orthodox, Roman Orthodox, Protestant. He was of another faith. And when one weds this sense of difference to the age-old trauma of anti-Semitism, one found that from the beginning of the century to the middle of the century to the end of the 19th century, there was not a decrease of anti-Semitism so much as an increase in anti-Semitism. In the 18th century, anti-Semitism had been religious. The Jew was blind to the saving mission of Christianity. Only faith in Christ saved, and the Jew, for some reason, refused to accept that doctrine of salvation. In the 19th century, which was more skeptical and less religious, where Europe was not Christian Europe, but now a series of nation states, a new anti-Semitic doctrine emerged. It was not now that we were blind, but that our genes were degenerate. There were the blue bloods, the true bloods, and then there was Jewish blood. And in Houston Chamberlain in England and Drummond in France and other people throughout the continent began to develop the background of a racist theory of exclusion. And for the first time, one began to see not the slow movement forward, deliberate step by step of liberalism, of more and more people emerging into acceptance into the establishment of a given country, more and more openly spoken anti-Semitism. The century which began with the French Revolution, liberty, equality, and fraternity, ended with the Russian pogroms, with Pleve, the Russian prime minister, saying, I will starve to death one-third of the Jews, I will force one-third of the Jews into exile, and I will see that one-third of the Jews are converted. Anti-Semitism becomes an open political purpose. Vienna, the most cultured city in Europe, was governed for the last decade of the 19th century by a city council, the majority of whom were members of a party which had a single name and a single plank, anti-Semitism. the anti-Semitic party, to remove the Jews from their positions, their newly won positions of opportunity in the community. And the mayor of Vienna, during that decade, was also elected on this anti-Semitic platform. There were the black shirts of reaction, and there were the black shirts of fascism. Europe, in this era of nationalism, instead of developing a nationalism which allowed all who had roots, ancestry within a given geographical area to be easily, openly accepted as citizens of a given state, began to develop principles of exclusion. And most of these were rather openly directed against the Jew. Zionism begins as a political movement among those analysts of the Jewish problem or the Jewish condition in mid and late 19th century Europe, who looked about them and who said, the great hope will not succeed. We can understand how at the beginning of the century, Jews looked forward to an emerging, unrolling litany of rights, how there was reason to believe that we would finally be accepted as part of a pluralistic society. But now that hope has been completely shattered. Looking out of his window in Paris during the Dreyfus trial, the Viennese theater critic, Theodor Herzl, sees tens of thousands of Frenchmen with black shirts marching down the Champs-Élysées, shouting, Abat les Juifs, Abat les Juifs, down with the Jews, down with the Jews. Now, this Westerner might not have been shocked had he been in St. Petersburg or Moscow, where anti-Semitism was an open and acknowledged policy. This was Tsarist Russia. This was reaction. But France was the home of the French Revolution. France was the home of Voltaire and Diderot and Montesquieu and of all the great enlightened of Europe. How could this be happening almost 100 years after the Great Revolution? And the Herzls of 19th century Jewry began to look upon the condition of the Jew in Europe as insoluble within European terms. Anti-Semitism, they said, is endemic. It's the racism of Western civilization. As long as the Jew remains in Europe, he will be an outsider, an alien, on sufferance. When a Frenchman travels, he's a visitor, accepted as an equal. Wherever the Jew is, he is on sufferance, on tolerance, because he has no place which is ultimately his own. The only solution to the problem of the Jew is to create a nation state like France, like England, like Italy, like the emerging countries of Eastern Europe, which will be a Jewish state, as there is a Hungarian state, or a Bulgarian state, or a Czech state, or a Slovak state. And in this state, Jews will find sovereignty, dignity, independence, but most of all, a home, a place that is their own, a passport which they can carry. Then they will no longer trouble Europe because they will have their own geography. They will be like all other nation states. We can deal with all other peoples from a position of equality rather than one of subservience. The Zionist analysis during the 19th and the 20th century was rejected by the vast majority of Jews. One can see this in many ways, by what I call the luggage vote. Because of the pogroms of Eastern Europe, families had to pack. Where did they come? Here. For every 1,000 who left Eastern Europe, and tens of thousands left every year, for every 1,000 that went west, one went to Palestine. And one can check this statistic out by the money vote. When the Herzls, when the Weizmanns, when the other leaders of Zionism went to the Jewish communities of the West for money to rebuild this land, which would be a solution to the Jewish problem, men turned their backs and closed their pocketbooks. Yes, we Jews have a great history of giving to Zion beginning in 1938. In 1925, The Berlin Jewish community raised more money for its local social agencies than the Zionist movement was able to raise worldwide for land buying, for human reclamation, for schools, for hospitals, for all that was required to rebuild the Holy Land. Why did Jews reject the analysis of Zionism, analysis which our hindsight after Stalin and after the Holocaust says was self-evident, obviously true? Because it's a pessimistic analysis. Because Palestine was a wasteland, and Europe was a center of culture, and America was the land of opportunity, the golden Medina. Because we could not believe that the racism of Europe was as basic, as endemic as it was. We continued to hold on to the false hope that these were only birth pangs, temporary aberrations, and when the economics of the situation got better, when people learned to live with the new nations and the new freedoms, they would quickly give up these ancient hates. They weren't part of the new world. There were two basic refutations of the Zionist position. One in Western Europe and America, and one in Eastern Europe. And these were the dominant and majority position among Jews. In Western Europe and America, the argument ran this way. We are better off than we were 50 years ago. Our children go to the state schools. Yes, there are some quotas. Yes, there are some forms of social ostracism. Yes, we do worry about what we may do, how what we do and say is taken by the non-Jewish world. But this is different. America is not Russia. Or more sarcastically, Germany is not Russia. And what's happening in Russia will not happen in the civilized West. Anti-Semitism is reaction. It's medieval. You won't find modern peoples being anti-Semitic. Give them time. And the reaction in Eastern Europe was largely one of socialist ideology. It seemed anachronistic to the socialist mind to create a nation state at the very time that internationalism, comradeship, the brotherhood of all the laboring peoples of the world was emerging into being. I'll give you an interesting figure, Moses Hess. Moses Hess lived in the middle of the 19th century. Moses Hess was one of the first ideological communists in Europe. During his early years, he was one of the collaborators with Marx and Engels, but he broke with Marx and Engels on one issue. Not on the issue of the necessity of the communist revolution, the economic revolution in Europe, but on the issue of whether or not that revolution could take place in all countries without consideration of the national myths, the histories, the backgrounds, the cultures of the individual countries, or whether there would be a Russian communism, a Polish communism, a German communism, that the revolution would take place within the myth, the history, the background of the individual countries. 80 years before Stalin, Moses Hess predicted Stalin, predicted that communism, when it finally emerged, would emerge not as an international movement, but as a movement of economic liberation within individual nation states. Now, they might have the power imperially to impose their will on other nation states, but communism, socialism did not have the power in its doctrine to override these ancient divisions between men. And the important fact that emerges here is that if communism cannot be, in a true sense, internationalism, this means that the nations will remain. This means that the Jewish question within the Soviet Union remains a question, or within a communist Poland remains a Jewish question, because what we have is both Russian and communist, and is not pure international communist at all. And of course, this is what came to be. And in the West, Hitler came to be. And Jews in the last 30 years have accepted the veracity, the clairvoyance, the clear-eyedness of the Zionist analysis, but only in the last 30 years. As a movement of nation building, Zionism was a movement among a minority of a minority, and the existence of the state is not a tribute to the united will of the Jewish people. I wish it were, but it's a tribute to the vision and the sacrifice of a small group within the Jewish community. But Israel is. We had 1948. The state came into being. And therefore, many who look back, Zionism ceases to be. As a movement which set out to build a nation state, it had accomplished its purpose. Obviously, one must do many things in order to secure the state. But can one say, in fact, that Zionism is, as opposed to the statement, Zionism was? And it's to that proposition that I'd like to turn our attention now. Zionism is. Not only are there Zionist organizations, the World Zionist Organization, the Zionist Organization of America, the Labor Zionist Organization. But from the very beginning, there was a dimension to Zionism which was broader than, and in a sense separate from, or the obverse of the position that was simply that of nation building. Zionism began not only as a movement to create a Jewish state, but as a program to renew the Jewish people, wherever they were. Until the 1940s, the Zionist movement spent more money on youth work, on education, outside the State of Israel in any one year than it spent within the State of Israel, or its predecessor, Palestine. Max Nordau, the name may not mean much to you, but Nordau was one of the great social and literary critics of Europe in the late 19th century. He was the great aide-de-camp to Herzl at every Zionist Congress in the 1880s and 1890s. Nordau would make the great philosophic and political presentation to draw the perspective, the outline of the world situation for those who had come. He was a very interesting man, a very brilliant writer. And he used to say, Zionism has two purposes. The first is to take the Jew out of the diaspora, to take the Jew out of an insoluble problem situation. And the other is to take the diaspora out of the Jew. As the Zionists looked about themselves at the Jews of Europe and of the world, they were disappointed and to a certain degree shocked. But what did they see? They saw in Eastern Europe timidity, fear, an inability of the men to stand up and to defend themselves. I read to you last week Bialik's poem about, in quotation mark, the Maccabees of Kishinev, the great Jewish heroes of that town who hid in the attics while their wives were being raped and their homes were being burnt. And that society which we have romanticized in the last 15 years in America with Fiddler and other characters such as these was a society of Luftmenschen, of those who had no jobs, who sat on the street corners, of men who engaged in the occupations which only impotent men engage in, who let their wives do what little work there was to be done. It was a society filled with all of the indices of psychological and spiritual deterioration. And in the West, what did we see? We saw Jews busy becoming non-Jews, changing their names, bobbing their noses. What did we see? We saw Jews who were always looking over their shoulders. Is it intelligent for a Jew to be, as Brandeis is, running as a nominated to be a member of the Supreme Court? Is it good for a Jew to be that prominent in American life? Is it good for a Jew to take an unpopular position? Shouldn't we take off our hats in the synagogue the way the non-Jews take off their hats in churches? Shouldn't we put behind us every Yiddish word we heard in our homes because this is the language of Eastern Europe and here we should speak only American and we want our children to be 101% American? The timidity. Ma yomru hagoyim, you know, the inevitable question, how will the non-Jew react? Rather than the basic question, what's right? This was the mark of the average assimilationist-minded Jew in the West. The dignity of Jewish life had disappeared. It had been shattered, it had been erased, it had been debased by centuries of persecution. And what was emerging was very much the kind of northern center city which black men of dignities began to recognize in the late 40s and 50s in the United States. A society of Uncle Toms, a society of the fearful, a society of those who either so intensified the way of life which was called religious that it became a cocoon, something they lived wholly within and they were afraid to move out of, or a society of those who were turning their way of life into something which was entirely different in value and in feel from what it had ever been. Zionism begins with a radical criticism of the Jew, and it insists that the only solution to a renewal of the Jewish spirit is first of all a sense of accomplishment, statehood, sovereignty, pride, responsibility for one's own destiny. Secondly, a revitalization of the kind of Jewish spirit which was natural and manly, if I can use that word in our age still to mean what I want it to mean, which was natural and which was manly and which was straightforward and which was not complicated by always wondering, if I say what Isaiah wants me to say, what will my banker think of me? How did the Zionist movement go about trying to accomplish these ends? Throughout Europe in the late 19th and early 20th century, there were camps and youth groups, and schools where Hebrew was the language of instruction. Hebrew was part of the armory of the Zionist movement. Yiddish was already a language inextricably tied in with Europe. Hebrew was our natural tongue. We could express ourselves easily in it. And in these camps, these young people came together to learn about a forest, about the soil, about themselves, about freedom, about the songs of unity within the Jewish people. The assimilated Jew spoke of the Jew alone walking out and perhaps doing a little charity, but living like unto all others. The Zionist Jew spoke of community, of unity, of cooperative endeavor. And not simply the creation of a Jewish hospital, because there happened to be a series of Protestant and Catholic hospitals in the town, and we had to do our share, but the creation of Jewish schools, and of Jewish theater, and of Hebrew classes, and of Jewish camps, of all those things which intensified identification. One's ability to be proud, Western, free, and a Jew. And it was not so much the creation of a Jewish national home in Palestine, which the Western Jew, the bourgeois Jew, the liberal Jew of the West was afraid of, but it was this insistence on particularity, on one's willingness to walk as a man, as a Westerner, and as a Jew, with positive content in each of these identifications which disturbed them. 25 years ago, 3 years after the death camps had been opened, already long after, just after the United Nations had voted partition, the creation of a Jewish state, when finally the Zionist thesis had been given the sanction of international authority, A group of Jews in Cleveland walked away from this congregation for another to create another congregation. They were no longer fighting the existence of a Jewish state. That was almost a fact of history by then. What disturbed them? The fact that we talked Hebrew in our religious school. The fact that here there was a certain kind of specific content, definition to Jewish life. That it wasn't a series simply of vague Christian quotes taken out of Scripture. That was the real argument. And it remains an argument today. For there are still Jews who accept Judaism as nothing more than a few great platitudes about justice and freedom and righteousness and love. The holidays, the disciplines, the language, the literature, the history, the uniqueness of the Jew means nothing to them except something they want to have no part with. And that's why there still is a Zionist movement. Because there are still Jews for whom Jewishness is a Judeo-Christianness, who are still afraid of being themselves, who believe in the Christian parts of Judaism and in the American parts of Judaism, but not in the Jewish parts of Judaism. And there are still Jews who look over their shoulder, who say to me, you know, Kissinger is a fairly bright guy, isn't he? But is it really wise for a Jew to be that important in government? Won't that increase anti-Semitism? And who do not understand me when I say to them, nothing increases anti-Semitism, it's already there. You may provide grist for the mill, but you don't create anti-Semitism. Let's take the Hatikva. In its earliest form, Hatikva was Lashuv Eretz Avotenu, to return to the land of our fathers. In its modern Israeli version, it's Liyot Am Chofshi B'Artzenu, to be a free people in our own land, to be a free people. What does it mean to be a free people? That remains the Zionist question. It remains to be a people who are able to do something about their own destiny, who will not be passive, who will not always accept the slings and arrows of an outrageous fortune and say, look at me, aren't I a good martyr? Liyot am chofshi, to be a free people. What does it mean? It means to freely look at one's society and to be willing to criticize its conventional values when these run counter to what one's belief believes to be the traditional Jewish values. It means to take, if we're diaspora Jews, to take democracy at its face value and to insist that we have the right to be different. We have the right to congregate. We have the right to have voluntary communities. We have the right to make collective decisions when they affect our special destiny. It does not mean that we live within a shell which is purely Jewish. It does mean that we live as Jews in a pluralistic society, and that we will do all that we can to give content, meaning, thrust, power to this term, Jew. Liyot am chofshi, so that in the end we can be a free and creative people. Not a timid people. Not a people that lives in the shadows. Not a people that refuses because of its fears to give something to the larger society, but a people that lives openly, in the sunshine, proudly, with conviction. But having said all of that, I would add this monition. It is too easy to leave it here and to think of Zionism, of freedom, as manliness, as strength, as the courage of one's convictions. There is nothing worse than a stupid conviction. And ignorant people often are belligerent about stupid convictions. Jewish life has any failing today. It's not really that the majority of us are timid, fearful, or Bialik's Maccabees way back there in Kishinev. It's the fact that we're ignorant. We don't know our own tradition. We haven't mastered our own language. We really don't know what it means to insist on Jewish values in a secular world. We talk a great deal about them, but we don't know what they mean. The Zionist budget of the Jewish Agency, is heavily committed to education, to learning. This congregation, which has been led by Zionist rabbis for almost 60 years now, has been heavily committed to education, to its library. How many read? And what of quality have you read? And how willing have you been to really try and come to grips in your lives, your spirit, with the term Jew and the history and literature of our people? Amen.